Can we talk about this death business for a minute? You said this third book was going to be about higher truths, about universal truths. Well, through all the conversations we've had, we haven't talked that much about death and what happens after that. Let's do that now. Let's get to that.
Fine. What do you want to know?
Well, what happens when you die?
What do you choose to have happen?
You mean that what happens is whatever we choose to have happen?
Do you think that just because you've died, you stop creating?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking you.
Fair enough. You do know, incidentally, but I see you've forgotten, which is great. Everything's gone according to plan. When you die, you do not stop creating. Is that definitive enough for you?
Yes.
Good. Now, the reason you do not stop creating when you die is that you don't ever die. You cannot. For you are life itself, and life cannot not be life. Therefore, you cannot die. So at the moment of your death, what happens is you go on living. This is why so many people who have died do not believe it. Because they do not have the experience of being dead. On the contrary, they feel, because they are, very much alive. So there's confusion. The self may see the body lying there, all crumpled up, not moving, yet the self is suddenly moving all over the place. It has the experience often of literally flying all over the room, then of being everywhere in the space, all at once. And when it desires a particular point of view, it suddenly finds itself experiencing that. If the soul, the name we will now give to the self, wonders, gee, why is my body not moving? It will find itself right there, hovering right over the body, watching the stillness curiously. Someone enters the room and the soul thinks, who is that? Immediately the soul is in front of or next to that person. Thus, in a very short time, the soul learns that it can go anywhere with the speed of its thought. A feeling of incredible freedom and lightness overtakes the soul, and it usually takes a little while for the entity to get used to all this bouncing around with every thought. If the person had children, and should think of those children, immediately the soul is in the presence of those children wherever they are. Thus the soul learns that not only can it be wherever it wants with the speed of its thought, it can be in two places at once, or three places, or five. It can exist, observe, and conduct activities in these places simultaneously, without difficulty or confusion. Then it can rejoin itself, returning to one place again, simply by refocusing. The soul remembers in the next life what it would have been well to remember in this life, that all effect is created by thought, and that manifestation is a result of intention.
What I focus on as my intention becomes my reality.
Exactly. The only difference is the speed with which you experience the result. In the physical life, there might be a lapse between thought and experience. In the spirit's realm, there is no lapse. Results are instantaneous. Newly departed souls, therefore, learn to monitor their thoughts very carefully. Because whatever they think of, they experience. I use the word learn here very loosely, more as a figure of speech than an actual description. The term remember would be more accurate. If physicalized souls learn to control their thoughts as quickly and as efficiently as spiritualized souls, their whole lives would change. In the creation of individual reality, thought control, or what some might call prayer, is everything.
Prayer?
Thought control is the highest form of prayer. Therefore, think only on good things and righteous. Dwell not in negativity and darkness. And even in moments when things look bleak, especially in those moments, see only perfection, express only gratefulness, and then imagine only what manifestation of perfection you choose next. In this formula is found tranquility. In this process is found peace. In this awareness is found joy.
That's extraordinary. That's an extraordinary piece of information. Thanks for bringing that through me.
Thanks for letting it come through. Sometimes you are cleaner than at other times. Some moment you are more open, like a strainer which has just been rinsed. It is more open. There are more holes open.
Good way of putting it.
I do my best. To recap, then, souls released from the body quickly remember to monitor and control their thoughts very carefully, for whatever they think of, that is what they create and experience. I say again, it is the same for souls still residing with the body, except the results are usually not as immediate. And it is the time lapse between thought and creation, which can be days, weeks, months, or even years, which creates the illusion that things are happening to you, not because of you. This is an illusion, causing you to forget that you are at cause in the matter. As I have described now several times, this forgetting is built into the system. It is part of the process, for you cannot create who you are until you forget who you are. So the illusion causing forgetfulness is an effect created on purpose. When you leave the body, it will therefore be a big surprise to see the instant obvious connection between your thoughts and your creations. It will be a shocking surprise at first, and then a very pleasant one, as you begin to remember that you were at cause in the creation of your experience, not at the effect of it.
Why is there such a delay between thought and creation before we die, or no delay at all after we die?
Because you are working within the illusion of time.
Mm.
There's no delay between thought and creation away from the body, because you are also away from the parameter of time.
In other words, as you have said so often, time does not exist.
Not as you understand it. The phenomenon of time is really a function of perspective.
Why does it exist while we are with the body?
You have caused it to by moving into, by assuming your present perspective. You use this perspective as a tool with which you can explore and examine your experiences much more fully by separating them into individual pieces rather than a single occurrence. Life is a single occurrence, an event of the cosmos that is happening right now. All of it is happening everywhere. There is no time but now. There is no place but here. Here and now is all there is. Yet you chose to experience the magnificence of here and now in its every detail, and to experience your divine self as the here and now creator of that reality. There are only two ways, two fields of experience in which you could do that. Time and space. So magnificent was this thought that you literally exploded with delight. In that explosion of delight was created space between the parts of you, and the time it took to move from one part of yourself to another. In this way, you literally tore yourself apart to look at the pieces of you. You might say that you were so happy, you fell to pieces. You've been picking up the pieces ever since.
That's all my life is. I'm just putting together the pieces, trying to see if they make any sense.
And it is through the device called time that you have managed to separate the pieces, to divide the indivisible, thus to see it and experience it more fully as you are creating it. Even as you look at a solid object through a microscope, seeing that it is not solid at all, but actually a conglomeration of a million different effects, different things all happening at once, and thus creating the larger effect. So too do you use time as the microscope of your soul. Consider the parable of the rock. Once there was a rock filled with countless atoms, protons, neutrons, and subatomic particles of matter. These particles were racing around continually in a pattern, each particle going from here to there and taking time to do so. Yet going so fast that the rock itself seemed to move not at all. It just was. There it lay, drinking in the sun, soaking up the rain, and moving not at all. What is this inside of me that is moving? The rock asked. It is you, said a voice from afar. Me, replied the rock. Why, that is impossible. I'm not moving at all. Anyone can see that. Yes, from a distance, the voice agreed. From way over here, you do look as if you were solid, still, not moving. But when I come closer, when I look very closely at what is actually happening, I see that everything that comprises what you are is moving. It is moving at incredible speed through time and space in a particular pattern which creates you as the thing called rock. And so you are like magic. You are moving and not moving at the same time. But, ask the rock, which then is the illusion? The oneness, the stillness of the rock? Or the separateness and the movement of its parts? To which the voice replied, which then is the illusion? The oneness, the stillness of God, or the separateness and movement of its parts? And I tell you this, upon this rock I will build my church, for this is the rock of ages. This is the eternal truth that leaves no stone unturned. I've explained it all for you here in this little story. This is the cosmology. Life is a series of minute, incredibly rapid movements. These movements do not affect at all the immobility and the beingness of everything that is. Yet, just as with the atoms of the rock, it is the movement which is creating the stillness right before your eyes. From this distance, there is no separateness. There cannot be. For all that is all there is, and there is nothing else. I am the unmoved mover. From the limited perspective with which you view all that is, you see yourself as separate and apart, not one unmovable being, but many, many beings constantly in motion. Both observations are accurate. Both realities are real.
And when I don't die at all, but simply shift into awareness of the macrocosm, where there is no time or space now and then, before and after.
Precisely. You've got it.
Let me see if I can say it back to you. Let me see if I can describe it.
Go ahead.
Well, from a macro perspective, there is no separateness, and from way back there, all the particles of everything merely look like the whole. As you look at the rock at your feet, you see the rock, right then and there, as whole, complete, and perfect. Yet even in the fraction of a moment that you hold that rock in your awareness, there's a lot going on within that rock. There's incredible movement at incredible speed of the particles of that rock. And what are those particles doing? They're making the rock what it is. As you look at this rock, you do not see this process. Even if you're conceptually aware of it, to you it's all happening now. The rock isn't becoming a rock. It is a rock right here, right now. Yet if you were the consciousness of one of the submolecular particles inside that rock, you would experience yourself moving at insane speed, first here, then there. And if some voice outside the rock said to you, it's all happening at once, you would call it a liar or a charlatan. Still, from the perspective of a distance from the rock, the idea that any part of the rock is separate from any other part, and further is moving around at insane speed, would appear to be the lie. From that distance could be seen what could not be seen up close, that all is one, and that all the movement hasn't moved anything.
You have it. You have a grasp of it. What you are saying, and you are correct, is that life is all a matter of perspective. If you continue to see this truth, you will begin to understand the macro reality of God, and you will have unlocked a secret of the whole universe. All of it is the same thing.
The universe is a molecule in the body of God.
That's actually not so very far off.
And it is to the macro reality that we return in consciousness when we do the thing called die?
Yes. Yet even the macro reality to which you return is but a micro reality of an even larger macro reality, which is a smaller part of a larger reality still, and so on and on and on, forever and ever and even forevermore, world without end. We are God, the it that is, constantly in the act of creating ourselves, constantly in the act of being what we are now, until we aren't that anymore, but become something else. Even the rock will not be a rock forever, but only what seems like forever. Before it was a rock, it was something else. It fossilized into that rock through a process taking hundreds of thousands of years. It was once something else and will be something else again. The same is true of you. You are not always the you that you are now. You are something else. And today, as you stand there in your utter magnificence, you truly are something else again.
Whoa, that's amazing. I mean, that's absolutely amazing. I've never heard anything like that. You've taken the whole cosmology of life and put it in terms I can hold in my mind. That's amazing.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm doing my best.
You're doing a damn good job.
That's probably not the phrase you should have chosen there.
Whoops.
Just kidding. Lightening things up here. Having a little fun. I cannot actually be offended that your fellow human beings often allow themselves to be offended on my behalf.
So I've noticed. But getting back, I think I've just caught hold of something.
What's that?
This whole explanation rolled out when I asked a single question. How come time exists when we're in the body but not when the soul is released? And what you seem to be saying is that time is really perspective, that it neither exists nor ceases to exist, but that as the soul alters its perspective, we experience ultimate reality in different ways.
That's exactly what I'm saying. You've got it.
And you are making the larger point that in the macrocosm, the soul is aware of the direct relationship between thought and creation, between one's ideas and one's experience.
Yes. At the macro level, it's like seeing the rock and seeing the movement within the rock. There is no time between the movement of the atoms and the appearance of the rock it creates. The rock is, even as the movements occur. Indeed, because the movements occur. This cause and effect is instant. The movement is occurring and the rock is being all at the same time. This is what the soul realizes at the moment of what you call death. It is simply a change in perspective. You see more, so you understand more. After death, you are no longer limited in your understanding. You see the rock, and you see into the rock. You will look at what now seem to be the most complex aspects of life and say, of course, it will all be very clear to you. Then there will be new mysteries for you to ponder. As you move around the cosmic wheel, there will be larger and larger realities, bigger and bigger truths. Yet if you can remember this truth, your perspective creates your thoughts, and your thoughts create everything. And if you can remember it before you leave the body, not after, your whole life will change.
Ah, and the way to control your thoughts is to change your perspective.
Precisely. Assume a different perspective, and you will have a different thought about everything. In this way, you will have learned to control your thought. And in the creation of your experience, controlled thought is everything. Some people call this constant prayer.
You said this before, but I don't think I've ever thought of prayer in this way.
Why not see what happens if you do so? If you imagined that the controlling and directing of your thoughts is the highest form of prayer, you would think only on good things and righteous. You would dwell not in negativity and darkness, though you may be immersed in it. And in moments when things look bleak, perhaps especially in those moments, you would see only perfection.
You have come back to that over and over again.
I am giving you tools. With these tools, you can change your life. I am repeating the most important of them over and over again.
I am repeating them, for repetition will produce recognition, knowing again, when you need it most. Everything that occurs, everything that has occurred, is occurring, ever will occur, is the outward physical manifestation of your innermost thoughts, choices, ideas, and determinations regarding who you are and who you choose to be. Condemn not, therefore, those aspects of life with which you disagree. seek instead to change them and the conditions that made them possible. Behold the darkness, yet curse it not. Rather be a light unto the darkness, and so transform it. Let your light so shine before men that those who stand in the darkness will be illumined by the light of your being, and all of you will see at last who you really are. Be a bringer of the light, for your light can do more than illuminate your own path. Your light can be the light which truly lights the world. Shine on then, O Illuminati. Shine on, that the moment of your greatest darkness may yet become your grandest gift. And even as you are gifted, so too will you gift others, giving to them the unspeakable treasure, themselves. Let this be your task. Let this be your greatest joy, to give people back to themselves, even in their darkest hour, especially in that hour. The world waits for you. Heal it. Now, in the place where you are, there is much you can do. For my sheep are lost and must now be found. Be ye therefore as good shepherds, and lead them back to me.
Thank you. Thank you for that call and for that challenge. Thank you for that placement of the goal before me. Thank you for always keeping me heading in the direction you know I really want to take. That is why I come to you. That is why I have loved and blessed this dialogue, for it is in conversation with you that I find the divine within me and begin to see it within all others.
My dearly beloved, the heavens rejoice when you say that. That is the very reason I have come to you and will come to everyone who calls to me, even as I come now to those others who are hearing these words. For this conversation was never intended to be with you alone. It was intended for millions around the world, and it has been placed in each person's hands just exactly when they have needed it, sometimes in the most miraculous ways. It has brought them to the wisdom they themselves have called forth, perfectly suited for this moment in their lives. This is the wonder of what has been happening here, that each of you is producing this result by yourself. It looks as if someone else gave you this material, brought you to this conversation, opened you to this dialogue, yet you brought yourself here. So let us now explore together the remaining questions which you have held in your heart.
May we please then speak more of life after death? You were explaining what happens to the soul after death, and I so want to know as much about that as I can.
We will speak of it then, until you're yearning has been satisfied. I said earlier that what happens is whatever you want to happen. I meant that. You create your own reality, not only when you are with the body, but when you are away from it. At first you may not realize this, and so you may not be consciously creating your reality. Your experience will then be created by one of two other energies, your uncontrolled thoughts or the collective consciousness. To the degree that your uncontrolled thoughts are stronger than the collective consciousness, to that degree you will experience them as reality. To the degree that the collective consciousness is accepted, absorbed, and internalized, to that degree you will experience it as your reality. This is no different from how you create what you call reality in your present life. Always in life you have before you three choices. One, you may allow your uncontrolled thoughts to create the moment. Two, you may allow your creative consciousness to create the moment. Three, you may allow the collective consciousness to create the moment. Here's an irony. In your present life, you find it difficult to create consciously from your individual awareness, and indeed, often assume your individual understandings to be wrong, given all that you are seeing around you, and so you surrender to the collective consciousness, whether it serves you to do so or not. In the first moments of what you call the afterlife, on the other hand, you may find it difficult to surrender to the collective consciousness, given all that you are seeing around you, which may be unbelievable to you. And so you will be tempted to hold to your own individual understandings, whether they serve you or not. I would tell you this. It is when you are surrounded by lower consciousness that you will benefit more from remaining with your individual understandings. And when you are surrounded by higher consciousness, that you receive greater benefit from surrender. It may therefore be wise to seek beings of high consciousness. I cannot overemphasize the importance of the company you keep. In what you call the afterlife, there is nothing to worry about on this score, for you will instantly and automatically be surrounded by beings of high consciousness and by high consciousness itself. Still, you may not know that you are being so lovingly enveloped. You may not immediately understand. It may therefore seem to you as if you are having things happen to you, that you are at the whim of whatever fortunes are working at the moment. In truth, you experience the consciousness in which you die. Some of you have expectations without even knowing it. All your life you've had thoughts about what occurs after death, and when you die, those thoughts are made manifest, and you suddenly realize, make real, what you've been thinking about. And it is your strongest thoughts, the ones you've held most fervently, that, as always in life, will prevail.
Then a person could go to hell. If people believed all during life that hell is a place which most certainly existed and that God will judge the quick and the dead, that he will separate the wheat from the chaff and the goats from the sheep, and that they are surely going to hell, given all they have done to offend God, then they would go to hell. They would burn in the everlasting fires of damnation. How do they escape it? You've said repeatedly throughout this dialogue that hell does not exist, yet you also say that we create our own reality and have the power to create any reality at all out of our thought about it. So hellfire and damnation could and does exist for those who believe in it.
Nothing exists in ultimate reality, save that which is. You are correct in pointing out that you may create any sub-reality you choose, including the experience of hell as you describe it. I've never said at any point in this entire dialogue that you could not experience hell. I said that hell does not exist. Most of what you experience does not exist, yet you experience it nonetheless.
This is unbelievable. A friend of mine named Barnett Bain just produced a movie about this. I mean, about this exactly. It's August 7th, 1998, as I speak these words, and I'm inserting this in the dialogue in between lines of a discussion of 2 years ago, and I have never done this before, but just before sending this to the publisher, I was rereading the manuscript one last time, and I realized, hold it. Robin Williams has just made a movie about exactly what we're talking about here. It's called What Dreams May Come. And it's a startling depiction on film of what you've just said.
I am familiar with it.
You are? God goes to the movie?
God makes movies.
Whoa.
Yes. You never saw Oh God?
Well, sure, but I never...
what do you think, God only writes books?
So is the Robin Williams movie literally true? I mean, is that how it is?
No. No movie or book or other human explanation of the divine is literally true.
Not even the Bible? The Bible is not literally true?
No, and I think you know that.
Well, what about this book? Surely this book is literally true.
No, I hate to tell you this, but you're bringing this through your personal filter.
Mm.
Now, I will agree that the mesh on your filter is thinner, finer. You've become a very good filter, but you are a filter nonetheless.
Yeah, I know that. I just wanted it stated again here, because some people take books like this and movies like What Dreams May Come as, well, as literal truths. And I want to stop them from doing that.
The writers and producers of that film brought some enormous truth through an imperfect filter. The point they sought to make is that you will experience after death exactly what you expect and choose to experience. They made that point very effectively. Now, shall we get back to where we were?
Yes. I'd like to know just what I wanted to know when I was watching that movie. If there is no hell, yet I am experiencing hell, what the hell is the difference?
There wouldn't be any as long as you remain in your created reality, yet you will not create such a reality forever. Some of you won't experience it for more than what you would call a nanosecond, and therefore you will not experience, even in the private domains of your own imagination, a place of sadness or suffering.
Well, what would stop me from creating such a place for all eternity if I believed all my life that there was such a place and that something I had done had caused me to deserve such a place?
Your knowledge and understanding. Just as in this life your next moment is created out of the new understandings you've gained from your last moment, so too in what you call the afterlife will you create a new moment from what you've come to know and understand in the old. And one thing you will come to know and understand very quickly is that you are at choice always about what you wish to experience. That is because in the afterlife, results are instantaneous, and you will not be able to miss the connection between your thoughts about a thing and the experience those thoughts create. You will understand yourself to be creating your own reality.
Well, this would explain why some people's experience is happy and some people's experience is frightening. Why some people's experience is profound while other people's experience is virtually non-existent. And why so many different stories exist about what happens in the moments after death. Some people come back from near-death experiences filled with peace and love and with no fear ever again of death. While others return very frightened, certain that they've just encountered dark and evil forces.
The soul responds to, recreates the mind's most powerful suggestion, producing that in its experience. Some souls remain in that experience for a time, making it very real, even as they remained in their experiences while with the body, though they were equally as unreal and impermanent. Other souls quickly adjust, see the experience for what it is, begin to think new thoughts, and move immediately to new experiences.
Do you mean that there is no one particular way that things are in the afterlife? Are there no eternal truths that exist outside of my own mind? Do we continue to go on creating myths and legends and make-believe experiences right past our death and into the next reality? When do we get released from the bondage? When do we come to know the truth?
When you choose to. That was the point of the Robin Williams movie. That is the point being made here. Those whose only desire is to know the eternal truth of all that is, to understand the great mysteries, to experience the grandest reality, do so. Yes, there is a one great truth. There is a final reality. But you will always get what you choose, regardless of that reality, precisely because the reality is that you are a divine creature, divinely creating your reality even as you are experiencing it. Yet should you choose to stop creating your own individual reality and begin to understand and experience the larger unified reality, you will have an immediate opportunity to do that. Those who die in a state of such choosing, of such desiring, of such willingness and such knowing, move into the experience of the oneness at once. Others move into the experience only if, as, and when they so desire. It is precisely the same when the soul is with the body. It is all a matter of desire, of your choosing, of your creating, and ultimately, of your creating the uncreatable. That is, of your experiencing that which has already been created.
This is the created creator, the unmoved mover. It is the Alpha and the Omega, the before and the after, the now, then, always aspect of everything which you call God. I will not forsake you, yet I will not force myself upon you. I've never done so, and I never will. You may return to me whenever you wish, now, while you are with the body, or after you have left it. You may return to the One and experience the loss of your individual self whenever it pleases you. You may also recreate the experience of your individual self whenever you choose. You may experience any aspect of the All that is that you wish, in its tiniest proportion, or its grandest. You may experience the microcosm or the macrocosm.
I may experience the particle or the rock.
Yes, good, you're getting this. When you reside with the human body, you are experiencing a smaller portion than the whole. That is, a portion of the microcosm, although by no means the smallest portion thereof. When you reside away from the body in what some would call the spirit world, you've enlarged by quantum leaps your perspective. You will suddenly seem to know everything, be able to be everything. You will have a macrocosmic view of things, allowing you to understand that which you do not now understand. One of the things you will then understand is that there is a larger macrocosm still. That is, you will suddenly become clear that all that is even greater than the reality you are then experiencing. This will fill you at once with awe and anticipation, wonder and excitement, joy and exhilaration. For you will then know and understand what I know and understand, that the game never ends.
Will I ever get to a place of true wisdom?
In the time after your death, you may choose to have every question you ever had answered and open yourself to new questions you never dreamed existed. You may choose to experience oneness with all that is, and you will have a chance to decide what you wish to be, do, and have next. Do you choose to return to your most recent body? Do you choose to experience life again in human form, but of another kind? Do you choose to remain where you are in the spirit world at the level you are then experiencing? Do you choose to go on, go further in your knowing and experiencing? Do you choose to lose your identity altogether and now become part of the oneness? What do you choose? What do you choose? What do you choose? Always that is the question I will be asking you. Always that is the inquiry of the universe. For the universe knows nothing except how to grant your fondest wish, your greatest desire. Indeed, it is doing that every moment, every day. The difference between you and me is that you are not consciously aware of this. I am.
Tell me, will my relatives, my loved ones, meet me after I die and help me understand what's going on, as some people say they will? Will I be reunited with those who have gone before? Will we be able to spend eternity together?
What do you choose? You choose for these things to happen? Then they will.
Okay, I'm confused. Are you saying that all of us have free will and that this free will extends even past our death?
Yes, that is what I am saying.
Well, if that's true, then the free will of my loved ones would have to coincide with mine. They must have the same thought and desire that I have when I'm having it, or they wouldn't be there for me when I die. Further, what if I wanted to spend the rest of eternity with them and one or two of them wanted to move on? Maybe one of them wanted to move higher and higher into this experience of reunification with the oneness, as you put it. Then what?
There is no contradiction in the universe. There are things that look like contradictions, but there are none, in fact. Should a situation arise such as the one you described, it's a very good question, by the way, what will happen is that you will both be able to have what you choose.
Both?
Both.
May I ask how?
You may.
Okay, how?
What is your thought about God? Do you think that I exist in one place, and one place only?
No, I think you exist everywhere at once. I believe God is omnipresent.
Well, you are right about that. There is nowhere that I am not. Do you understand this?
I think so.
Good. So what makes you think it's any different with you?
Well, because you're God and I'm a mere mortal.
I see. We're still hung up on this mere mortal thing.
Okay. Suppose I assume for the sake of discussion that I too am God, or at least made up of the same stuff as God. Then are you saying that I too can be everywhere, all the time?
It is merely a matter of what the consciousness chooses to hold in its reality. In what you would call the spirit world, what you can imagine, you can experience. Now, if you want to experience yourself being one soul in one place at one time, you may do that. Yet if you wish to experience your spirit being larger than that, being in more than one place at one time, you may do that as well. Indeed, you may experience your spirit as being anywhere you wish, any time. That is because, in truth, there is only one time and one place, and you are in all of it always. You may thus experience any part or parts of it you wish, whenever you choose.
But what if I want my relatives to be with me, but one of them wants to be a part of the all that is somewhere else? What then?
It is not possible for you and your relatives not to want the same thing. You and I and your relatives and I, all of us, are one and the same. The very act of your desiring something is the act of me desiring something, since you are simply me, acting out the experience called desire. Therefore, what you desire, I desire. Your relatives and I are also one and the same. Therefore, what I am desiring, they are desiring. So it follows then that what you desire, your relatives are also desiring. On earth, it is also true that all of you desire the same thing. You desire peace. You desire prosperity. You desire joy. You desire fulfillment. You desire satisfaction and self-expression in your work, love in your life, health in your body. You all desire the same thing. You think this is a coincidence? It is not. It is the way life works. I'm explaining that to you right now. Now, the only thing that's different on Earth from the way it is in what you call the spirit world is that on Earth, while you all desire the same thing, you all have different ideas about how to go about having it. So you're all going in different directions seeking the same thing. It is these differing ideas you have that produce your differing results. These ideas might be called your sponsoring thoughts. I have spoken to you of this before.
Yes, in Book One.
One such thought which many of you share in common is your idea of insufficiency. Many of you believe at the core of your being that there is simply not enough of anything. There's not enough love, not enough money, not enough food, not enough clothing, not enough shelter, not enough time, not enough good ideas to go around, and certainly not enough of you to go around. This sponsoring thought causes you to employ all sorts of strategies and tactics in seeking to acquire what you think there is not enough of. These are approaches you would abandon at once when you clear that there is enough for everybody, of whatever it is that you desire. In what you call heaven, your ideas of not enoughness disappear because you become aware that there is no separation between you and anything you desire. You are aware that there's even more than enough of you. You are aware that you can be in more than one place at any given time, so there is no reason not to want what your brother wants, not to choose what your sister chooses. If they want you in their space at the moment of their death, the very thought of you calls you to them, and you have no reason not to race to them, since your going there takes away nothing from whatever else you may be doing. This state of having no reason to say no is the state in which I reside at all times. You've heard it said before, and it is true. God never says no. I will give you all exactly what you desire always, even as I have done from the beginning of time.
Are you really always giving everyone exactly what they desire at any given time?
Yes, my beloved, I am. Your life is a reflection of what you desire, and what you believe you may have of what you desire. I cannot give you what you do not believe you may have, no matter how much you desire it, because I will not violate your own thought about it. I cannot. That is the law. Believing that you cannot have something is the same thing as not desiring to have it, for it produces the same result.
But on Earth, we cannot have whatever we desire. We can't be in two places at once, for instance. And there are many other things we may desire but can't have, because on Earth, we're all so limited.
I know that you see it that way, and so that is the way it is for you. For one thing that remains eternally true is that you'll always be given the experience you believe you will be given. Thus, if you say that you cannot be in two places at once, then you cannot be. But if you say that you can be anywhere you wish with the speed of your thought, and can even make yourself manifest in physical form in more than one place at any given time, then you may do that.
Now, you see, that's where this dialogue leaves me. I want to believe that this information is coming straight from God, but when you say things like that, I get all crazy inside because I just can't believe that. I mean, I just don't think that what you said there is true. Nothing in the human experience has demonstrated that.
On the contrary, saints and sages of all religions have been said to have done both of these things. Does it take a very high level of belief, an extraordinary level of belief, the level of belief attained by one being in 1,000 years? Yes. Does that mean it is impossible? No.
How can I create that belief? How can I get to that level of belief?
You cannot get there. You can only be there. And I'm not trying to play with words. I mean that. This kind of belief, what I would call complete knowing, is not something you try to acquire. In fact, if you are trying to acquire it, you cannot have it. It is something you simply are. You simply are this knowing. You are this being. Such beingness comes out of a state of total awareness. It can come out of only such a state. If you are seeking to become aware, then you cannot be. It's like trying to be 6 feet tall when you are 4 foot nine. You cannot be 6 feet tall. You can only be what you are, 4 foot nine. You will be 6 feet tall when you grow into that. When you are 6 feet tall, you will then be able to do all the things that 6 foot tall people can do. And when you are in a state of total awareness, then you will be able to do all the things that beings in a state of total awareness can do. Do not therefore try to believe that you can do these things. Try instead to move to a state of total awareness. Then belief will no longer be necessary. Complete knowing will work its wonders.
Once, when I was meditating, I had the experience of total oneness, of total awareness. It was wonderful. It was ecstatic. Ever since then, I've been trying to have that experience again. I sit in meditation and try to have that total awareness again, but I've never been able to. This is the reason, right? You're saying to me that as long as I am seeking to have something, I cannot have it, because my very seeking is a statement that I do not now have it. The same wisdom you've been giving me throughout this dialogue.
Yes, yes, now you understand it. It's becoming more clear to you now. That is why we keep going around in circles here. That is why we keep repeating things, revisiting things. You get it the third, the fourth, maybe the fifth time around.
Well, I'm glad I asked the question, because this could be dangerous stuff, you know, this business about you can be in two places at once, or you can do anything you want to do. This is the kind of stuff that makes people run to jump off the Empire State Building shouting, "I'm God, look at me, I can fly."
You'd better be in a state of total awareness before you do that. If you have to prove yourself to be God by demonstrating it to others, then you do not know yourself to be. And this not knowing will demonstrate itself in your reality. In short, you will fall flat on your face. God seeks to prove itself to no one, for God has no need to do that. God is, and that is what is so. Those who know themselves to be one with God or have the experience of God within have no need, nor do they seek to prove that to anyone, least of all, themselves. And so it was that when they taunted him, saying, "If you are the Son of God, come down from that cross," the man called Jesus did nothing. Yet 3 days later, quietly and unobtrusively, when there were no witnesses and no crowds and no one to whom to prove anything, he did something a great deal more astonishing, and the world has been talking about it ever since. And in this miracle is found your salvation, for you have been shown the truth, not only of Jesus, but of who you are, and may thus be saved from the lie about yourself, which you have been told, and which you have accepted as your truth. God invites you always to your highest thought about yourself. There are those on your planet right now who have manifested many of these higher thoughts, including causing physical objects to appear and disappear, making themselves appear and disappear, even living forever in the body or coming back to the body and living again. And all of this has been made possible because of their faith, because of their knowing, because of their immutable clarity about how things are and how they are meant to be. And while in the past, whenever people in earthly form have done these things, you have called the events miracles and have made the people saints and saviors, yet they are no more saints and saviors than you, for you are all saints and saviors, which is the very message they have been bringing you.
How can I believe that? I want to believe that with all my heart, but I can't. I just can't.
No, you cannot believe it. You can only know it.
But how can I know it? How can I come to that?
Whatever you choose for yourself, give to another. If you cannot come to that, help someone else come to that. Tell someone else that they already have. Praise them for it. Honor them for it. This is the value in having a guru. That's the whole point. There's been a lot of negative energy in the West on the word guru. It has almost become pejorative. To be a guru is to somehow be a charlatan. To give your allegiance to a guru is to somehow give your power away. Honoring your guru is not giving away your power. It is getting your power. For when you honor the guru, when you praise your master teacher, what you say is, "I see you." And what you see in another, you can begin to see in yourself. It is outward evidence of your inner reality. It is outward proof of your inner truth, the truth of your being. This is the truth which is being brought through you in the books you write.
I don't see myself as writing these books. I see you, God, as the author, and me merely as the scribe.
God is the author, and so are you. There is no difference between my writing them and you writing them. As long as you think there is, you will have missed the point of the writing itself. Yet most of humanity has missed this teaching. And so I send you new teachers, more teachers, all with the same message as the teachers of old. I understand your reluctance to accept the teaching as your own personal truth. Were you to go around claiming to be one with God, or even a part of God, speaking or writing these words, the world would not know what to make of you.
People can make of me whatever they wish. This much I know. I don't deserve to be the recipient of the information I've been given here. And in all of these books, I don't feel worthy to be the messenger of this truth. I'm working on this third book, yet I know even before its release that I, of all people, with all the mistakes I've made, all the selfish things I've done, am simply not worthy to be the bringer of this wonderful truth. Yet that, perhaps, is the greatest message of this trilogy. That God stays hidden from no man, but speaks to everyone, even the least worthy among us. For if God will speak to me, God will speak directly into the heart of every man, woman, and child who seeks the truth. There is thus hope for all of us. None of us is so horrible that God would forsake us, nor so unforgivable that God would turn away.
Is that what you believe? All of that which you have just written?
Yes.
Then so be it. And so shall it be with you. Yet I tell you this, you are worthy, as is everyone else. Unworthiness is the worst indictment ever visited upon the human race. You have based your sense of worthiness on the past, while I base your sense of worthiness on the future. The future. The future. Always the future. That is where your life is, not in the past. The future. That is where your truth is, not in the past. What you have done is unimportant compared to what you are about to do. How you have erred is insignificant compared to how you are about to create. I forgive your mistakes, all of them. I forgive your misplaced passions, all of them. I forgive your erroneous notions, your misguided understandings, your hurtful actions, your selfish decisions, all of them. Others may not forgive you, but I do. Others may not release you from your guilt, but I do. Others may not let you forget, allow you to go on, become something new, but I do. For I know that you are not what you were, but are and always will be what you are now. A sinner can become a saint in 1 minute, in 1 second, in 1 breath. In truth, there is no such thing as a sinner, for no one can be sinned against, least of all me. That is why I say that I forgive you. I use the phrase because it is one you seem to understand. In truth, I do not forgive you, and will not forgive you ever for anything. I do not have to. There is nothing to forgive, but I can release you, and I hereby do, now, once again, as I have done so often in the past, through the teachings of so many other teachers.
Why have we not heard them? Why have we not believed this, your greatest promise?
Because you cannot believe in the goodness of God. Forget then about believing in my goodness. Believe instead in simple logic. The reason I have no need to forgive you is that you cannot offend me, nor can I be damaged or destroyed. Yet you imagine yourself capable of offending, even damaging me. What a delusion. What a magnificent obsession. You cannot hurt me, nor can I be harmed in any way. For I am the unharmable, and that which cannot be harmed cannot and would not harm another. You understand now the logic behind the truth that I do not condemn, nor shall I punish, nor have I any need to seek retribution. I have no such need, for have not been and cannot be offended or damaged or hurt in any way. The same is true of you and of all others. Though all of you imagine that you can be and have been hurt and damaged and destroyed. Because you imagine damage, you require revenge. Because you experience pain, you need another to experience pain as retribution for your own. Yet what possible justification can that be for inflicting pain upon another? Because you imagine someone has inflicted injury upon you, you feel it right and proper to inflict injury in return. That which you say is not okay for human beings to do to each other is okay for you to do so long as you are justified. This is insanity. And what you do not see in this insanity is that all people who inflict pain on others assume themselves to be justified. Every action a person takes is understood by that person to be the right action, given what it is they seek and desire. By your definition, what they seek and desire is wrong. But by their definition, it is not. You may not agree with their model of the world, with their moral and ethical constructions, with their theological understandings, nor with their decisions, choices, and actions. But they agree with them based on their values. You call their values wrong. But who's to say your values are right? Only you. Your values are right because you say they are. Even this might make some sense if you kept your word about it. But you, yourself, change your mind constantly about what you consider right and wrong. You do this as individuals, and you do this as societies. What your society considered right just a few decades ago, you consider wrong today. What you considered wrong in the not-too-distant past, you now call right. Who could tell what is what? How do you know the players without a scorecard?
And yet we dare to sit in judgment of one another. We dare to condemn because some other person has failed to keep up with our own changing ideas about what is permitted and what is not. We're really something. We can't even keep our own minds made up about what's okay and what's not.
That isn't the problem. Changing your ideas of what's right and wrong isn't the problem. You have to change those ideas or you would never grow. Changing is a product of evolution. No, the problem is not that you have changed or that your values have changed. The problem is that so many of you insist on thinking that the values you now have are the right and perfect ones, and that everyone else should adhere to them. Some of you have become self-justified and self-righteous. Stick to your beliefs, if that serves you. Hold tight, do not waver, for your ideas about right and wrong are your definitions of who you are. Yet do not require that others define themselves according to your terms. And do not stay so stuck in your present beliefs and customs that you halt the process of evolution itself. Actually, you could not do that if you wanted to, for life goes on with you or without you. Nothing stays the same, nor can anything remain unchanged. To be unchanged is to not move, and to not move is to die. All of life is motion. Even rocks are filled with motion. Everything moves. Everything. There is nothing that is not in motion. Therefore, by the very fact of motion, nothing is the same from one moment to the next. Nothing. Remaining the same or seeking to moves against the laws of life. This is foolish because in this struggle, life will always win. So change. Yes, change. Change your ideas of right and wrong. Change your notions of this and that. Change your structures, your constructions, your models, your theories. Allow your deepest truths to be altered. Alter them yourself, for goodness sake. I mean that quite literally. Alter them yourself, for goodness sake. Because your new idea of who you are is where the growth is. Your new idea of what is so is where evolution accelerates. Your new idea of the who, what, where, when, how, and why of it is where the mystery gets solved, the plot unravels, the story ends. Then you can begin a new story, and a grander one. Your new idea about all of it is where the excitement is, where the creation is, where God in you is made manifest and becomes fully realized. No matter how good you think things have been, they can be better. No matter how wonderful you think your theologies, your ideologies, your cosmologies, they can be full of even more wonder. For there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Be open, therefore. Be open. Don't close off the possibility of new truths because you've been comfortable with an old one. Life begins at the end of your comfort zone. Yet be not quick to judge another. Rather seek to avoid judgment, for another person's wrongs were your rights of yestermorn. Another person's mistakes are your own past actions, now corrected. Another person's choices and decisions are as hurtful and harmful, as selfish and unforgivable, as many of your own have been. It is when you just can't imagine how another person could do such a thing that you've forgotten where you came from and where both you and the other person are going. And to those of you who think yourselves to be the evil ones, who think yourselves to be unworthy and irredeemable, I tell you this. There's not a one among you who is lost forever, nor will there ever be. For you are all in the process of becoming. You are all moving through the experience of evolution. That is what I am up to. Through you.
I remember a prayer I was taught as a child. Lord, I am not worthy that thou shouldst enter under my roof. Yet say but the word, and my soul shall be healed. You have said these words, and I feel healed. I no longer feel unworthy. You have a way of making me feel worthy. If I could give one gift to all human beings, that would be it.
You have given them that gift with this dialogue.
I would like to keep on giving it when this conversation is over.
This conversation will never be over.
Well, then, when this trilogy is complete.
There will be ways for you to do that.
For that, I'm very happy, because this is the gift my soul yearns to give. All of us have a gift to give. I'd like this to be mine.
Go then. And give it. Seek to make everyone whose life you touch feel worthy. Give everyone a sense of their own worthiness as a person, a sense of the true wonder of who they are. Give this gift, and you will heal the world.
I humbly ask your help.
You will always have it. We're friends.
Meanwhile, I'm loving this dialogue. I would like to ask a question about something you said before.
I'm here.
When you were talking about life between lives, so to speak, you said you may recreate the experience of your individual self whenever you choose. What does that mean?
It means you may emerge from the all anytime you wish, as a new self or the same self you were before.
You mean I can retain and return to my individual consciousness, my awareness of me?
Yes. You may have at all times whatever experience you desire.
And so I can return to this life, to the earth, as the same person I was before I died?
Yes.
In the flesh?
Have you heard of Jesus?
Oh, yes, but I'm not Jesus, nor would I ever claim to be like him.
Did he not say, these things and more shall you also do?
Well, yes, but he wasn't talking about miracles like that, I don't think.
I'm sorry, you don't think so. Because Jesus was not the only one to have risen from the dead.
He wasn't? Others have risen from the dead?
Yes.
My God, that's blasphemy.
It's blasphemy that someone other than Christ has risen from the dead?
Well, some people would say that it is.
Then those people have never read the Bible.
The Bible? The Bible says that people other than Jesus came back to the body after death?
Ever hear of Lazarus?
Oh, no fair. It was through the Christ power that he was raised from the dead.
Precisely. And you think that Christ power, as you call it, was reserved only for Lazarus? One person in the history of the world?
Well, I hadn't thought about it that way.
I tell you this. Many have there been who have been risen from the dead. Many have there been who have come back to life. It's happening every day, right now, in your hospitals.
Oh, come on. No fair again. That's medical science, not theology.
Oh, I see. God has nothing to do with today's miracles, only yesterday's.
Okay. Okay, I'll give you the point on technical grounds, but no one has raised himself from the dead on their own like Jesus did. No one has come back from the dead that way.
Are you sure?
Well, pretty sure.
Have you ever heard of Mahavatar Babaji?
I don't think we should bring Eastern mystics into this. A lot of people don't buy that stuff.
I see. Well, of course, they must be right.
Well, let me get this straight. Are you saying that souls can return from the so-called dead in spirit form or in physical form, if that's what they desire?
You're beginning to understand now.
All right, then why haven't more people done it? Why don't we hear about it every day? This kind of thing would make international news.
Actually, a lot of people do it in spirit form. Not many, I'll admit, choose to return to the body.
Ha, there, I gotcha. Why not? If this is so easy, why don't more souls do it?
It's not a question of ease, it's a question of desirability.
Meaning?
Meaning, it's a very rare soul who desires to return to physicality in the same form as before. If a soul chooses to return to the body, it almost always does so with another body, a different one. In this way, it begins a new agenda, experiences new rememberings, undertakes new adventures. Generally, souls leave bodies because they're finished with them. They've completed what they joined with the body to do. They've experienced the experience they were seeking.
What about people who die by accident? Were they finished with their experience, or was it cut off?
Do you still imagine people die by accident?
You mean they don't?
Nothing in this universe occurs by accident. There is no such thing as an accident, nor is there any such thing as coincidence.
If I could convince myself that was true, I would never mourn again for those who have died.
Mourning for them is the last thing they would want you to do. If you knew where they were and that they were there by their own higher choice, you would celebrate their departure. If you experienced what you call the afterlife for one moment, having come to it with your grandest thought about yourself and God, you would smile the biggest smile at their funeral and let joy fill your heart.
We cry at funerals for our loss. It's our sadness in knowing that we will never see them again, never hold or hug or touch or be with someone we loved.
And that is a good crying. That honors your love and your beloved. Yet even this mourning would be short if you knew what grand realities and wondrous experiences await the joyous soul leaving the body.
What is it like in the afterlife? Really, tell me. Tell me all of it.
There are some things which cannot be revealed, not because I do not choose to, but because in your present condition, at your present level of understanding, you would be unable to conceive of what is being told to you. Still, there is more which can be said. As we discussed earlier, you may do one of three things in what you call the afterlife, just as in the life you are now experiencing. You may submit to the creations of your uncontrolled thoughts. You may create your experience consciously out of choice, or you may experience the collective consciousness of all that is. This last experience is called reunification, or rejoining the One. Should you take the first path, most of you will not do so for very long, unlike the way you behave on Earth. This is because in the moment you don't like what you're experiencing, you will choose to create a new and more pleasant reality, which you will do by simply stopping your negative thoughts. Because of this, you will never experience the hell of which you are so afraid, unless you choose to. Even in that case, you will be happy in that you will be getting what you want. More people than you know are happy being miserable. So you will keep experiencing it until you don't choose to anymore. For most of you, the moment you even begin to experience it, you will move away from it and create something new. You can eliminate the hell in your life on Earth exactly the same way. Should you take the second path and consciously create your experience, you will no doubt experience going straight to heaven, because this is what anyone who is freely choosing and who believes in heaven would create. If you do not believe in heaven, you will experience whatever you wish to experience, and the moment you understand that, your wishes will get better and better, and then you will believe in heaven. Should you take the third path and submit to the creations of the collective consciousness, you will move very quickly into total acceptance, total peace, total joy, total awareness, and total love, for that is the consciousness of the collective. Then you will become one with the oneness, and there will be nothing else except that which you are, which is all there ever was, until you decide that there should be something else. This is nirvana, the one with the oneness experience that many of you have had briefly in meditation, and it is an indescribable ecstasy. After you experience the oneness for an infinite time, no time, you will cease to experience it. because you cannot experience the oneness as oneness unless and until that which is not one also exists. Understanding this, you will create, once again, the idea and the thought of separation or disunity. Then you will keep traveling on the cosmic wheel, keep going, keep circling, keep on being forever and ever, and even forevermore. You will return to the oneness many times, an infinite number of times, and for an infinite period each time. And you will know that you have the tools to return to the oneness at any point on the cosmic wheel. You may do so now, even as you are hearing this. You may do so tomorrow in your meditation. You may do so at any time.
And you've said that we do not have to stay at the level of consciousness we're at when we die?
No. You may move to another as quickly as you wish, or take as much time as you like. If you die in a state of limited perspective and uncontrolled thoughts, you'll experience whatever that state brings you until you don't want it anymore. Then you'll wake up, become conscious, and start experiencing yourself creating your reality. You'll look back at the first stage and call it purgatory. The second stage, when you can have anything you want with the speed of your thought, you'll call heaven. The third stage, when you experience the bliss of the oneness, you'll call nirvana.
I have one more thing I'd like to explore along these lines. It's not about after death, but it is about experiences outside the body. Can you explain those to me? What's happening there?
The essence of who you are has simply left the physical body. This can happen during normal dreaming, often during meditation, and frequently in a sublime form while the body is in deep sleep. During such an excursion, your soul can be anywhere it wishes. Frequently,
the person reporting such an experience has no after memory of having made volitional decisions about this. They may experience it as just something that happened to me. However, nothing which involves an activity of the soul is non-volitional.
How can we be shown things? How can things be revealed to us during one of these experiences if all we are doing is creating as we go along? It seems to me that the only way things could be revealed to us would be if those things existed separate from us, not as part of our own creation. I need some help with this.
Nothing exists separate from you, and everything is your own creation. Even your apparent lack of understanding is your own creation. It is literally a figment of your imagination. You imagine that you do not know the answer to this question, and so you do not. Yet as soon as you imagine that you do, you do. You allow yourself to do this sort of imagining so that the process can go on.
The process?
Life. The eternal process. In those moments during which you experience yourself being revealed to yourself, whether these are what you call out-of-body experiences or dreams or magic moments of wakefulness when you are greeted by crystal clarity, what has happened is that you have simply slipped into remembering. You are remembering what you have already created, and these rememberings can be very powerful. They can produce a personal epiphany. Once you've had such a magnificent experience, it can be very difficult to go back to real life in a way that blends well with what other people are calling reality. That is because your reality has shifted. It has become something else. It has expanded, grown, and it cannot be shrunk again. It's like trying to get the genie back in the bottle. It can't be done.
Well, is that why so many people who come back from out-of-body experiences or so-called near-death experiences sometimes seem very different?
Exactly. And they are different because now they know so much more. Yet frequently, the further they get from such experiences, the more time that passes, the more they revert to their old behaviors because they have again forgotten what they know.
Is there any way to keep remembering?
Yeah. Act out your knowingness in every moment. Keep acting on what you know rather than what the world of illusion is showing you. Stay with it no matter how deceiving appearances are. This is what all masters have done and do. They judge not by appearances but act according to what they know. And there is another way to remember.
Yes?
Cause another to remember. That which you wish for yourself, give to another.
That's what I feel I'm doing with these books.
That is exactly what you are doing. The longer you keep on doing it, the less you will have to do it. The more you send this message to another, the less you will have to send it to yourself.
Because myself and the other are one, and what I give to another, I give to myself.
You see? Now you are giving me the answers. And that, of course, is how it works.
Wow, I just gave God an answer. That is cool. That is really cool.
You're telling me.
That's what's cool. The fact that I'm telling you.
And I will tell you this. The day will come when we will speak as one. That day will come for all people.
Well, if that day is going to come for me, I'd like to make sure I understand exactly what it is you're saying. So I'd like to go back to something else just one more time. I know you said this more than once, but I really want to make sure I understand it. Am I clear that once we reach this state of oneness, which many call nirvana, once we return to the source, we don't stay there? The reason I'm asking this again is that this seems to run counter to my understanding of many Eastern esoteric and mystical teachings.
To remain in the state of sublime no-thing, or oneness with the all, would make it impossible to be there. As I've just explained, that which is cannot be, except in the space of that which is not. Even the total bliss of oneness cannot be experienced as total bliss, unless something less than total bliss exists. So, something less than the total bliss of total oneness had to be, and continually has to be, created.
But when we are in total bliss, when we have merged once more with the oneness, when we have become everything nothing, how can we even know that we exist? I mean, since there's nothing else that we are experiencing, I don't know. I don't seem to be able to understand this. This is one thing I can't seem to get a handle on.
You are describing what I call the divine dilemma. This is the same dilemma God has always had, and that God solved with the creation of that which was not God, or thought it was not. God gave and gives again in every instant a part of itself to the lesser experience of not knowing itself. So that the rest of itself can know itself as who and what it really is. Thus, God gave his only begotten Son that you might be saved. You see now from where this mythology has sprung.
Well, I think that we're all God. That we are constantly, every one of us, journeying from knowing to not knowing to knowing again. From being to not being to being again. From oneness to separation to oneness again. In a never-ending cycle. That this is the cycle of life. What you call the cosmic wheel.
Exactly. Precisely. That is well said.
But do we all have to go back to ground zero? Do we always have to start over completely? Go back to the beginning? Return to square one? Do not pass go? Do not collect $200?
You do not have to do anything. Not in this lifetime. Not in any other. You will have choice. Always you will have free choice. To go anywhere you wish to go, do anything you wish to do, in your recreation of the experience of God. You can move to any place on the cosmic wheel. You may come back as anything you wish, or in any other dimension, reality, solar system, or civilization you choose. Some of those who have reached the place of total union with the divine have even chosen to come back as enlightened masters. And yes, some were enlightened masters when they left. And then chose to come back as themselves. You must surely be aware of reports of gurus and masters who have returned to your world over and over again, manifesting in repeated appearances throughout the decades and centuries. You have one entire religion based on such a report. It is called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and it is based on the report of Joseph Smith that the being calling himself Jesus returned to Earth many centuries after his apparently final departure, this time appearing in the United States. So you may return to any point on the cosmic wheel to which it pleases you to return.
Still, even that could be depressing. Don't we ever get to rest? Don't we ever get to stay in nirvana? To remain there? Are we doomed forever to this coming and going? This now you see it, now you don't treadmill? Are we on an eternal journey to nowhere?
Yes. That's the greatest truth. There's nowhere to go, nothing to do, and no one you have to be.
Except exactly who you're being right now. The truth is that there is no journey. You are right now what you are attempting to be. You are right now where you are attempting to go. It is the master who knows this, and thus ends the struggle. And then does the master seek to assist you in ending your struggle, even as you will seek to end the struggle of others when you reach mastery. Yet this process, this cosmic wheel, is not a depressing treadmill. It is a glorious and continual reaffirmation of the utter magnificence of God and all life, and there is nothing depressing about that at all.
Still seems depressing to me.
Let me see if I can change your mind. Do you like sex?
I love it.
Most people do, except those with really weird ideas about it. So what if I told you that beginning tomorrow, you can have sex with every single person for whom you felt attraction and love? Would that make you happy?
Would this have to be against their will?
No, I would arrange it so that everyone you wish to celebrate the human experience of love with in this way also wishes to do so with you. They would feel great attraction and love for you.
Wow, hey, okay.
There's just one condition. You have to stop between each one. You can't just go from one to the other without interruption.
You're telling me.
So in order to experience the ecstasy of this kind of physical union, you have to also experience not being united sexually with someone, if only for a while.
I think I see where you're going.
Yes. Even the ecstasy would not be ecstasy were there not a time when there was no ecstasy. This is as true with spiritual ecstasy as it is with physical. There is nothing depressing about the cycle of life. There is only joy. Simply joy and more joy. True masters are never less than joyful. This staying at the level of mastery is what you may now find desirable. Then you can move in and out of the ecstasy and still be joyful always. You do not need the ecstasy to be joyful. You are joyful simply knowing that ecstasy is.
I'd like to change the subject now, if I could, and talk about earth changes. But before I do, I'd like to make just an observation, if I could. It seems as though there are a lot of things being said here more than once. I sometimes feel like I'm hearing the same things over and over again.
That's good, because you are. As I said earlier, this is by design. This message is like a spring. When it is coiled, it circles back onto itself. One circle covers the other, and it seems to be literally going around in circles.
Mm-hmm.
Only when the spring is uncoiled will you see that it stretches out in a spiral farther than you could have ever imagined. Yes, you are right. Much of what is being said has been said a number of times in different ways, sometimes in the same way. The observation is correct. When you are finished with this message, you should be able to repeat its essential points virtually verbatim. The day may come when you may wish to.
Okay, fair enough. Now, moving forward, a bunch of people seem to think that I have a direct line to God, and they want to know, is our planet doomed? I know I've asked this before, but now I'd really like a direct answer. Will the Earth changes occur, as so many are predicting? And if not, what are all those psychics seeing? A made-up vision? Should we be praying, changing? Is there anything we can do, or is it all, sadly, hopeless?
I will be happy to address those questions. But we will not be moving forward.
We won't?
No. Because the answers have already been given you in my several previous explanations of time.
You mean the part about everything that's ever going to happen has already happened?
Yes.
But what is the everything that has already happened? How did it happen? What happened?
All of it happened. All of it has already happened. Every possibility exists as fact, as completed events.
How can that be? I don't understand how that can be.
I'm going to put this in terms to which you can better relate. See if this helps. Have you ever watched children use a CD-ROM to play a computerized video game?
Yes.
Have you ever asked yourself how the computer knows how to respond to every move the child makes with the joystick?
Yes, actually, I have wondered that.
It's all on the disc. The computer knows how to respond to every move the child makes because every possible move has already been placed on the disc, along with its appropriate response.
That's spooky. Almost surreal.
What? That every ending and every twist and turn producing that ending is already programmed on the disc? There's nothing spooky about it. just technology. And if you think that the technology of video games is something, wait till you see the technology of the universe. Think of the cosmic wheel as that CD-ROM. All the endings already exist. The universe is just waiting to see which one you choose this time. And when the game is over, whether you win, lose, or draw, the universe will say, "Wanna play again?" Your computer disk doesn't care whether you win or not, and you can't hurt its feelings. It just offers you a chance to play again. All the endings already exist. And which ending you experience depends on the choices you make.
Whoa. So God is nothing more than a CD-ROM.
I wouldn't put it that way exactly.
Okay.
But throughout this dialogue, I've been trying to use illustrations that embody concepts everyone can hold in their understanding. So I think the CD-ROM illustration is a good one. In many ways, life is like a CD-ROM. All the possibilities exist and have already occurred. Now you get to select which one you choose to experience. This relates directly to your question about earth changes. What many of the psychics are saying about the earth changes is true. They've opened a window onto the future and they have seen it. The question is, which future have they seen? As with the end of the game on the CD-ROM, there is more than one version. In one version, the earth will be in upheaval. In another version, it won't. Actually, all of the versions have already happened. Remember? Time...
I know. Time does not exist.
That's right. And so?
So, everything's happening at once.
Right again. All that has ever happened, is happening now, and ever will happen, exists right now. Just as all the moves in the computer game exist right now on that disk. So if you think it would be interesting for the doomsday predictions of the psychics to come true, focus all your attention on that, and you can draw that to yourself. And if you think you would like to experience a different reality, focus on that, and that is the outcome you can draw to you.
So you won't tell me whether the earth changes will occur or not, is that it?
I'm waiting for you to tell me. You will decide by your thoughts, words, and actions.
Okay, well, how about the year 2000 computer problem? There are those who are saying now that what we are now calling the Y2K glitch is going to be the cause of a great upheaval in our social and economic systems. Will it be?
What do you say? What do you choose? Do you think that you have nothing to do with any of this? I tell you, that would be inaccurate.
Won't you just tell us how this will all turn out?
I am not here to predict your future, and I will not do that. This much I can tell you. This much anybody can tell you. If you are not careful, you will get exactly where you are going. If, therefore, you don't like the way you are headed, change direction.
How do I do that? How do I affect such a large outcome? What should we do in the face of all these predictions of disaster by persons of psychic or spiritual authority?
Go inside. Search your place of inner wisdom. See what this calls on you to do, then do it. If that means write your politicians and your industrialists, asking them to take action on environmental abuses that could lead to earth changes, do it. If that means bringing your community leaders together to work on the Y2K problem, do it. And if that means just walking your path, sending out positive energy every day, and keeping those around you from falling into a panic which brings on a problem, do it. Most important of all, do not be afraid. You cannot die in any event, so there's nothing to be afraid of. Be aware of the process unfolding. And quietly know that everything is going to be okay with you. Seek to get in touch with the perfection of all things. Know that you will be exactly where you have to be in order to experience exactly what you choose as you go about creating who you really are. This is the way to peace. In all things, see the perfection. Finally, don't try to get out of anything. What you resist persists. I told you that in the first book, and it's true. People who are sad about what they see in the future, or what they've been told about the future, are failing to stay in the perfection.
Okay, any other advice?
Celebrate. Celebrate life. Celebrate self. Celebrate the prediction. Celebrate God. Celebrate. Play the game. Bring joy to the moment, whatever the moment seems to bring, because joy is who you are and who you will always be. God cannot create anything imperfect. If you think that God can create anything imperfect, then you know nothing of God. So celebrate. Celebrate the perfection. Smile and celebrate and see only the perfection. And that which others call the imperfection will not touch you in any way which is imperfect for you.
You mean I can avoid the earth shifting on its axis, or being smashed by a meteor, or being crumpled by earthquakes, or being caught in a confusing and hysterical aftermath of Y2K?
You can definitely avoid being affected negatively by any of that.
That isn't what I asked you.
But it is what I answered. Face the future fearlessly, understanding the process and seeing the perfection of all of it. That peace, that serenity, that calmness will lead you away from most of the experiences and outcomes others would have called negative.
What if you are wrong about all of this? What if you are not God at all, but just the overworkings of my fertile imagination?
Back to that question, huh?
Yeah.
Well, what if? So what? Can you think of a better way to live? All I'm saying here is to stay calm. Stay peaceful. Stay serene. In the face of these dire predictions of planet-wide calamity, and you will have the best outcome possible. Even if I'm not God, and I'm just you, making it all up, can you get any better advice?
No, I think not.
So, as usual, it makes no difference whether I'm God or not. But this is what the information in all three books just live the wisdom. Or if you can think of a better way to proceed, do that. Look, even if it really is just Neil Donald Walsh doing the talking in all these books, you can hardly find better advice to follow on any of the subjects covered. So look at it this way. Either I am God talking, or this Neil fellow's a pretty bright guy. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is, if I were convinced it was really God saying these things, I'd listen more closely.
Oh, bananas. I've sent you messages 1,000 times in 100 different forms. You've ignored most of them.
Yeah, I suppose I have.
You suppose?
Okay, I have.
So this time, don't ignore. Who do you suppose brought you to this book? You did. So if you can't listen to God, listen to yourself.
Or my friendly psychic.
Or your friendly psychic.
You're kidding with me now, I know, but this does bring up another subject I wanted to discuss.
I know.
You know?
Of course. You want to discuss psychics.
How did you know?
I'm psychic.
Hey, I'll bet you are. You're the mother of all psychics. You're the chief honcho, the top banana, the big cheese. You're the man, the boss, the unit, the chairman of the board.
My man, you have got it right.
Give me fire.
Cool, brother. Right on.
So what I want to know is, what is psychic power?
You all have what you call psychic power. It is truly a sixth sense. And you all have a sixth sense about things. Psychic power is simply
the ability to step out of your limited experience into a broader view, to step back, to feel more than what the limited individual you have imagined yourself to be would feel, to know more than he or she would know. It is the ability to tap into the larger truth all around you, to sense a different energy.
How does one develop this ability?
Develop is a good word. It's sort of like muscle. You all have them, yet some of you choose to develop them, whereas in others they remain undeveloped and far less useful. To develop your psychic muscle, you must exercise it, use it, every day, all the time. Right now, the muscle is there, but it's small, it's weak, it's underused. So you'll get an intuitive hit now and then, but you won't act on it. You'll get a hunch about something, but you'll ignore it. You'll have a dream or an inspiration, but you'll let it pass, paying it scant attention. Thank goodness you did pay attention to the hit you had about this book, or you wouldn't be hearing these words now. You think you came to these words by accident? By chance? So the first step in developing psychic power is to know you have it and to use it. Pay attention to every hunch you have, every feeling you feel, every intuitive hit you experience. Pay attention. Then act on what you know. Don't let your mind talk you out of it. Don't let your fear pull you away from it. The more that you act on your intuition fearlessly, the more your intuition will serve you. It was always there, only now you're paying attention to it.
But I'm not talking about the always finding a parking space kind of psychic ability. I'm talking about real psychic power, the kind that sees into the future, the kind that lets you know things about people you'd have no way of knowing otherwise.
That's what I was talking about, too.
Well, how does this psychic power work? Should I listen to people who have it? If a psychic makes a prediction, can I change it, or is my future set in stone? How can some psychics tell things about you the minute you walk into the room? What if I were...
Wait. That's four different questions there. Let's slow down a bit and try one at a time.
All right. How does psychic power work?
There are three rules of psychic phenomena that will allow you to understand how psychic power works. Let's go over them. One, all thought is energy. Two, all things are in motion. Three, all time is now. Psychics are people who have opened themselves to the experiences these phenomena produce, vibrations. Sometimes formed as pictures in the mind, sometimes a thought in the form of a word. The psychic becomes adept at feeling these energies. This may not be easy at first because these energies are very light, very fleeting, very subtle. Like the slightest breeze on a summer night that you think you felt rustle your hair, but maybe didn't. Like the faintest sound in the farthest distance that you think you heard, but can't be sure. Like the dimmest flicker of an image at the corner of your eye that you swore was there, but when you look head on, it's gone, vanished. Was it there at all? That's the question the beginning psychic is always asking. The accomplished psychic never asks, because to ask the question sends the answer away. Asking the question engages the mind, and that's the last thing a psychic wants to do. Intuition does not reside in the mind. To be psychic, you've got to be out of your mind, because intuition resides in the psyche, in the soul. Intuition is the ear of the soul. The soul is the only instrument sensitive enough to pick up life's faintest vibrations, to feel these energies, to sense these waves in the field, and to interpret them. You have six senses, not five. They are your sense of smell, taste, touch, sight, hearing, and knowing. So here is how psychic power works. Every time you have a thought, it sends off an energy. It is energy. The soul of the psychic picks up that energy. The true psychic will not stop to interpret it, but will probably just blurt out what the energy feels like. That's how a psychic can tell you what you're thinking. Every feeling you've ever had resides in your soul. Your soul is the sum total of all your feelings. It is the repository. Even though it may have been years since you've stored them there, a psychic who is truly open can feel these feelings here and now. That's because, all together now,
there's no such thing as time.
That's how a psychic can tell you about your past. Tomorrow also doesn't exist. All things are occurring right now. Every occurrence sends off a wave of energy. Prints an indelible picture on the cosmic photographic plate. The psychic sees or feels the picture of tomorrow as if it's happening right now, which it is. That is how some psychics tell the future. How is this done physiologically? Perhaps without actually knowing what he's doing, a psychic, through the act of intense focusing, is sending out an actual submolecular component of himself. His thought, if you will, leaves the body, zings out into space, and goes far enough, fast enough, to be able to turn around and see from a distance the now that you have not yet experienced.
Submolecular time travel.
You could say that.
Submolecular time travel.
Okay. We've decided to turn this into a vaudeville show?
No. I'll be good, I promise. Really. Go on. I really do want to hear this.
Okay. The submolecular part of the psychic, having absorbed the energy of the image gained from focusing, zings back to the psychic's body, bringing the energy with it. The psychic gets a picture, sometimes with a shiver, or feels the feeling, and tries very hard not to do any processing of the data, but simply and instantly describes it. The psychic has learned not to question what he's thinking, or suddenly seeing or feeling, but merely to allow it to come through as untouched as possible. Weeks later, if the event pictured or felt actually occurs, the psychic is called a clairvoyant, which of course is true.
Well, if that's the case, how come some predictions are wrong? That is, that they never happen.
Because the psychic has not predicted the future, merely offered a glimpse of one of the possible possibilities observed in the eternal moment of now. It is always the subject of the psychic reading who has made the choice. He could just as easily make another choice, a choice not in concert with the prediction. The eternal moment contains all possible possibilities. As I've explained now several times, everything has already happened in a million different ways. All that's left is for you to make some perception choices. It's all a question of perception. When you change your perception, you change your thought, and your thought creates your reality. Whatever outcome you could anticipate in any situation is already there for you. All you have to do is perceive it, know it. This is what is meant by, even before you ask, I will have answered. In truth, your prayers are answered before the prayer is offered.
Then how come we don't all get what we pray for?
This is covered in Book 1. You don't always get what you ask, but you always get what you create. Creation follows thought, which follows perception.
This is mind-boggling. Even though we've been over this before, this is still mind-boggling.
Isn't it, though? That's why it's good to keep going over it. Hearing it several times gives you a chance to wrap your mind around it. Then your mind gets unboggled.
Well, if everything is all happening now, what dictates which part of it all I'm experiencing in my moment of now?
Your choices and your belief in your choices. That belief will be created by your thoughts on a particular subject, and those thoughts arise out of your perceptions, that is, the way you look at it. So the psychic sees the choice you are now making about tomorrow and sees that played out. But a true psychic will always tell you it doesn't have to be that way. You can choose again and change the outcome.
In effect, I'd be changing the experience I've already had.
Exactly. Now you're getting it. Now you're understanding how to live in the paradox.
But if it's already happened, to whom has it happened? And if I change it, who is the me that experiences the change?
There is more than one of you moving down the timeline. This was all described in detail in Book 2. I'm going to suggest that you go over that. Then combine what's there with what's here for a richer understanding.
Okay, fair enough. But I would like to talk about this psychic stuff a while longer. A lot of people claim to be psychic. How can I tell the real from the fake?
Well, everyone is psychic, so they're all real. What you want to look for is their purpose. Are they seeking to help you or to enrich themselves? Psychics, so-called professional psychics, who are seeking to enrich themselves, often promise to do things with their psychic power, return a lost lover, bring wealth and fame, even help you lose weight. They promise they can do all this, but only for a fee. They'll even do a reading on another, your boss, your lover, a friend, and tell you all about them. They'll say, bring me something, a scarf, a picture, a sample of their handwriting. And they can tell you about the other, often quite a bit. Because everyone leaves a trace, a psychic fingerprint, an energy trail, and a true sensitive can feel this. But a sincere intuitive will never offer to cause another to come back to you, get a person to change his mind, or create any result whatsoever with her psychic power. A true psychic, one who has given her life to the development and use of this gift, knows that another's free will is never to be tampered with, and that another's thoughts are never to be invaded, and that another's psychic space is never to be violated.
I thought you said there is no right and wrong. What are all these nevers all of a sudden?
Every time I lay down an always or a never, it is within the context of what I know you are seeking to accomplish, what it is you are trying to do. I know that you are all seeking to evolve, to grow spiritually, to return to the oneness. You are seeking
to experience yourself as the grandest version of the greatest vision you ever had about who you are. You are seeking this individually and as a race.